Your comments about the ethical, one other doorway I've been interested in Torrance is the whole notion of Christ being the personalizing person and the humanizing. Again, he didn't develop that, but I think those are other doorways that show there's a pathway to take, a trajectory in Torrance that shows us the way. Would you agree with that?
I think that's... really a development of the same point about our creaturehood, our humanity having a place in the life of God. I think that's quite a nice way of putting it. And it's our personhood, I suppose, by some analogy with the divine persons. There might be a danger of an excessive anthropocentrism if one pushes that too hard. Whereas in the incarnation, it's our creaturehood, it's our flesh that is assumed. But I think that's quite a helpful way of looking at it. Yeah. And there is a personalism in Torrance's thought. He makes extensive use of McMurray, particularly in the 1960s, which I've always found quite attractive. David.
Thank you very much, David, for the papers. You know, my project at the moment is trying to think about the more than human reference, where the more than human belong is various aspects of Christian doctrine, and I have to confess this essentialism locus I've thought of before, but it seems to me that there is a danger of a theological asymmetry, that the word in which all things, through whom all things were made, comes down to us, and then when Christ is taken up, the language quoted from Torrance at one point was that a human space is made for us, or something of that kind. But at another point you talked about creatures with reference, and in this company I hesitate to confess an ignorance of Torrance's work. And would there be any structural difficulty within Torrance's thought for opening up the ascension as Christ representative of all creation, playing that role in the ascension?
I don't think so. I think you could develop his doctrine of the incarnation in that way, seeing his doctrine of creation as well as incarnation. There's something of the orthodox idea, I think, of human beings as priests of creation, so that there is a representative function, not just with respect to other human beings in the incarnation, but with respect to the whole of creation, that's taken up into the life of God and redeemed. I don't think that's stressed enormously in Torrance, but I suspect the resources are there to do that. So that while in a sense you continue to have a certain kind of anthropocentrism, it's a rather more benign type, and one which does have the space for other forms of creaturehood. I'm not aware of anyone who's worked on Torrance from that perspective, but there may be people out there who've looked at it. Yeah. So.
Address Torrance's understanding of the nature of the humanity which ascended, the nature of the humanity that Christ assumed in the first place. It seems to me there's a big division here with, you know, some rather old-fashioned words like peccability and so on. But as I understand Torrance, it is a quote-unquote fallen humanity that Christ assumes and sanctifies. And that is what is ascended in heaven. That is what becomes savingly available to us. Is that a fair way of saying it?
Yes, I think it is. That's roughly what's going on. It's through the whole person and work of Christ that we are justified and sanctified, and the ascended Christ is the sanctified human being who is our advocate. And there is the sense of the reality of heaven as characterized by the redemption of space and time. I think that's quite a difficult notion, but it's pointing in that same direction. But he, along with Barthes and Edward Irving, he wants to say that, you know, it's a fallen human nature that the Son of God assumes, though without compromising his sinless perfection.
Well, I noticed that Oliver Twist and Donald McLeod challenged that notion. I mean, it's quite appealing to me, towards it, but there's another trajectory here that others follow.
Yeah, there's a debate out there about whether the notion of Christ assuming a fallen human nature is a lapse from the evangelical traditions of the Church. I'm not troubled by it myself. I think in a way it's part of the logic of the Incarnation that it has to be our nature that the Son of God assumes, and not some kind of ideal or prelapsarian version of human nature. There's someone at the very back wanting to get in, yeah.
You mentioned metaphysics at one point. I'm just wondering if the Lawrence account, if it requires a certain kind of substance metaphysics, or what kind of ontology is underneath it, or assumed in it, or necessary to it, if any.
Yeah. He certainly seems to me to be working with an ontology of being in action. It's an ontology of it's partly an ontology of events, but it's one in which beings are identified and coordinated by their actions and relations with other beings. Now I find his use of relativity theory quite difficult, not only because I don't grasp relativity theory very well, although that's certainly a feature of it, but because he of course has to apply relativity theory analogically to the life of God. I mean, space and time, under the terms of relativity theory, are still aspects of created reality rather than uncreated reality. So it's not that a grasp of relativity theory will enable one simply to understand the life of God in itself. But I think it does enable him a kind of analogical set of concepts in which to speak more functionally about the risen and ascended human Christ, rather than statically or substantively. So I'm groping here, but I don't know if Luco can help us out.
I had a small problem with his notion of relational conception of space and time, based on a relativistic view of time, whereas this completely the other way around is another kind of concept. And he is confusing, in my opinion, these two concepts, relativistic theory and relational theory. Whereas if you stress the relational theory, you can develop more the notion of what you call the horizontal or ethical sociological notion of interaction between human beings and the divine being. And in the end of the day, his idea of space and time were shared by God and creatures.
Shared by
God
and creatures. Yeah.
Of course, in a qualified sense, but the sense is there's more analogy between that sense, to space of God and created space. And in that sense, you've got the problem that you want to talk about, the redemption of space and time. And it's a principle. Space and time is part of creation, whereas redemption belongs to the notion of the relation between you, creature, and God. And if you want to apply it to the whole creation, then it's only the whole creation that is redeemed, and not space and time, because there are simply concepts for us to talk about creation. So I think there is a way that if you want to stress the notion of relationality, you have the possibility to say a lot of theology of torrents, but not in the way of the relativistic theory or more. So complicating and helpful.
Do you think he's right to say that the Lutheran view assumes a receptacle account of space and time? Yeah.
That has more to do with the notion of unity.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is what the Luther has in mind, and I think what at the end of the day, Dr. thinks that you have to have as an idea.
Yeah. I've always found John Lucas's notion of divine temporality quite useful, where he says you can think of temporality in relation relative to the life of God. If one thinks of the divine life as having its own dynamics, and Torrens, I think, isn't moving in a similar direction when he speaks about there being place and time within the life of God for us and for our humanity. Now, place and time are appearing in inverted commas, and they're clearly being used analogically. But if one thinks about the movement of the divine life and these notions as relative, then, you know, we can get some purchase on that.
And it's important that you have to stress the priority of the divine life. We can talk about the divine life, concepts of space and time, but not the other way around.
Yes.
The same way as we can talk about human life with the help of concepts of space and time, and not the other way around. Because we have normally the mind.
Thanks.
Thank you for your paper. I would be very interested in hearing your comments on the extent to which you think Torrens gives us a more adequate doctrine of the spirit, if that is his abiding criticism of Barth. I would be interested in hearing your comment on that, especially in relation to the sense in which the ascension, if the ascension does denote the ongoing ministry of the historical Christ, Torrens' pneumatology give us
some purchase on the efficaciousness of that ongoing ministry? Well, first, I'm not sure how fair Barth is to Torrens on that particular point about Barth lacking an adequate pneumatology. I think the material that one finds in the later Barth on ethics, for example, it does provide quite a rich pneumatology. But what Torrens, I think, seeks to do is to offer us a pneumatology that is more closely related to and in some ways more continuous with his account of the person and work of Christ. And it's particularly in this notion that there is a sacramental relation between the world and the ascended Christ. That I think is what what you won't find in Bart for various reasons. And it's in that place that Torrance's pneumatology does work that is not matched in Bart's theology. I think he would say that that's what he was trying to do, and that that's where the lacuna is in Bart, and it comes from a failure sufficiently to prioritize notions of our union with Christ and the heavenly priesthood of the ascended Christ. So I think at that point, you know, Torrance is on to something, but I think just bluntly to say that Bart doesn't have a pneumatology, or I think one has to gloss that, yeah.
Regarding sacramental union, does he ever tackle, to your knowledge, the question of the episcopacy? He's so Anglican in so many ways.
Yes.
My reading of him, I'm Anglican, so I'm sure it's prejudicial, but it seems to me that given his emphasis upon the ascension, the ongoing presence of Christ, is consistent with a more Presbyterian ecclesiology, Presbyterian polity. Does he ever address the question?
Yes, he does. I think you'll find that in volume 2 of Conflict and Agreement. His mother was an Anglican, wife is an Anglican, and he was quite deeply committed to the project of uniting the Church of Scotland with the Church of England, and he defends episcopacy largely along the lines of Calvin and Book 4 of the Institutes, that the bishop is a primus inter pares who is set apart for an episcopal function. So he would, I think, want to bring together, fuse in some way episcopacy and Presbyterianism, and have a bishop within a presbytery. That's the kind of view that he argued. There was a report submitted to the General Assembly in the mid-1950s, arguing for this concept of episcopacy, and had it been accepted, it would have led to the union of the Church of Scotland with the Church of England. And Torrance, along with some pretty big hitters in the Kirk at that time, supported the bishop's report. But he and his colleagues were defeated by this very visceral Presbyterian reaction against bishops that you get in Scotland. And there was a campaign led by the Scottish Daily Express, popular newspaper, arguing that Scottish national identity would be undermined if bishops were introduced into the national church. So even Tom Torrance, John Bailey, and various others working together couldn't swing it in favour of bishops and presbytery. He doesn't see the bishop as fulfilling a separate order of ministry. There is one ministry of word and sacrament, and the bishop would be a minister of word and sacrament who is set apart by his her colleagues for that purpose. No. Be the church, yes. Yes. Yeah.
And that somehow it is not something done to them by the priests. However, that wasn't what I wanted to say. I wanted to thank you, first of all, David, for a very lucid and balanced and sufficiently critical paper. I thought excellent paper. In the beginning, you referred to Torrance in relation to Manila, and that triggered off in my mind the fact that both of them, I think, in rather different ways, were indebted to somebody else that I have sometimes called the most stimulating, I use the word advisedly, theologian, but in fact, essentially, namely, P.T. Forsyth. And McKinnon, of course, was very indebted to him on the question of theodicy. And I suspect that if
the expert here on Torrance, but to look at Forsyth and to look at what he says again about both kenosis and clerosis they might see there some clues of an ecclesiological, of an eschatological and Christological nature, which would trigger off things that they could then find in Torrance. As for ecclesiology, you refer to Torrance on the third part of the continuation of the incarnation, and of course, the Jesuits said that was strongly, of course, I when he said, that which owes its being to a rebirth cannot be the continuation of the ever sinless. And so I think there are interesting things in the background of the Canonicals, in course I thought. Secondly, I thought that probably Torrance would be really more upset by some of the written ways of talking about infinity than even about some of the full content. And thirdly, towards the end of your paper, you talk about the pastoral and the church being derived from ascension, the doctrine of ascension. And I do believe that that is the case, and I want to believe that it's astonishingly difficult to, ministers find, to cope with this in their churches. And when I sit under ministers at the sanctuary tide, I find they very often talk to me about their peace and justice, or else they start cracking on that rule on the journey. They don't quite find any good friends, and after that, we'll sing some dreadful dirge, which is allegedly something to do with the Celts. And in other words, they are. This is very unfortunate, and I, as I'm getting here, my anecdotage, I can perhaps tell you how I've suffered. Not from those kind of preachers, but from being one. Because early in my ministry here, I had this Bulmanian phase. It lasted about 2 weeks. and during that 3 weeks, you see, ascension time fell. And in my congregation, there was a very elderly, very wise Methodist minister at the time, a blood clergyman. At the end of every sermon, he would say to me, that were a grand message, man. And then I preached this sermon on ascension, being influenced by Buddha, and I managed to do it without making a single special reference. And at the end he said to me, hey, that were a grand message, lad. And he propped me in the chest and said, but he did go up.
Thank you very much. I don't know what Tom Torrance thought of P.T. Forsyth. I mean, he was very negative around kenotic Christology, even though Forsyth's take on it is about as good as you get. But I think the associations of kenotic Christology with Lutheranism were such that it was damned in the eyes of TFT. H.R. McIntosh is one of his theological heroes, but not on account of his views on kenotic Christology. Whereas, yeah, you're right, MacKinnon was more enthusiastic about Forsyth. I think the kind of rhetorical side of Forsyth would have been attractive to MacKinnon. I remember him speaking at the MacKinnon conference that Trevor Hart organized in Aberdeen, as you did. You were a contributor then in the early 90s. Yeah. I also remember standing in the courtyard of King's College, Old Aberdeen, with Ian Torrance when he had his two Dachshund puppies. He would walk around the courtyard with one under either arm when they were still very small. And we were having a long conversation, and the Dachshunds were sort of grazing around the lawn and the courtyard, and the Bishop of Aberdeen and Orkney came round the corner wearing his purple vestock and cross, and the dogs started barking furiously at the Bishop, and they they wouldn't let off and barked so loudly and the sound echoing all around the courtyard that we had to abandon the conversation, and the bishop sort of waved to us and walked off, and then the dogs calmed down, and Ian turned round and said to me, "David, I've been training these dogs to be good Presbyterians." I think that's a very good point, and possibly the relative absence of much material on vocation in Torrance as opposed to Bart does actually illustrate that point, that there is less about the horizontal in Torrance as opposed to Bart. I think that there's such a strong stress on the doxological and the sacramental that maybe there is rather less on vocation. I mean, there's a strong account of vocation, of course, in his theology of ministry, the call of God to ministry of word and sacrament, and the call of God to the whole church. But I don't think there's anything like the very developed account of vocation that you have in Karl Barth. It's a point that John Webster makes in that very nice obituary notice in the International Journal, where he says that Torrance was, in his view, rather sort of tone deaf to the ethical side of Barth's church dogmatics. He felt that there was somehow a loss of sympathy at that point.
Do you think he might have been concerned about dualism, spiritualizing, privatizing of the gospel on the one hand? He was clearly concerned about that Christ has reconciled all things and has transformed everything, the entire cosmos. On the other hand, a concern about secularizing and politicizing the gospel, and that the church should find its service in Jesus Christ as the church in the world. Could that not be a point of integration here?
Yeah, I think you're onto something there, that there's this fear in Torrance that the Reformed tradition tends to set the bar too high for people pastorally, evangelically. We require people to conform to certain types of ideas or patterns of conversion or narratives of their Christian commitment. And I think in Torrance there's this loathing of the way in which the Reformed tradition has sometimes divided people, sheep from the goats, the fencing of the communion table. And he sees that as, you know, almost quasi-Pelagian. He was very unhappy with the way in which his work on baptism was legislated for by the Church of Scotland, and felt that parents were asked to jump through too many hoops before the church agreed to baptize their children. So I think that might partly explain why there's rather less about the Christian life in Torrance than one might have expected, or as one finds in Bart, for example.
Can you criticize Bart as being too political?
I'm not aware of him doing that. I do know that he would say occasionally in public that he did not share Bart's political sympathies, particularly in the Cold War era. I think that would be one difference between Tom and James Torrance. I mean, James Torrance's political commitments, his political interpretation of the gospel were certainly to the left of his brother.
Tom was a theologian of the church and not an ideologue. That could be a contribution to the discussion of theology and politics.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think one can compliment his work or take it in directions that he might not have done so. For all of us, theology is contextual and autobiographical to a degree. And I know that Tom Torrance was very impatient with what he regarded as the rather lazy and unrigorous type of report that the Left of Centre Church and Nation Committee produced year after year in the General Assembly. He was, I think, persuaded by some of his elder son's views on economics, and, you know, was one of the few people in the Church of Scotland that spoke positively about the Thatcher government, for example, in the late 80s. I mean, that's where he was at that time, but it's possible within the same theological paradigm to do other things, as I think J.B. Torrance illustrates.
Thank you very much, David, for everything.